Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
I'm Jerry Pippin. Good to have you listening. And we are talking with Bill Hamilton here, and Bill is an interesting fellow to say the least. The name of the book is The Phoenix Lights Mystery. It happened
March 13th, 1997. And the reason why I wrote this book now is that there were television programs, there were radio programs covering the incidents that occurred on that night over Arizona. However, the television programs presented a very simplified picture, and they only talked about two events. And yet, our investigation revealed that there might have been at least 10 events that happened on that same day.
Now, and they were spread throughout the West there, or right around the Phoenix area?
Well, we had reports coming in from, at least later I found this out, coming in from California, southern Nevada, northern Arizona, and in particular, some of the objects that were seen, objects which I call VLOs, very large objects, were seen in the northwest part of the state of Arizona, and they seemed to follow a trajectory from the northwest to the southeast, so that when they came into the northeast, or the northwest corner of the Valley of the Sun, as it's called, which includes Phoenix and all the surrounding little cities and suburbs, around about 8:15 on that night, there were several people out for a walk, or maybe just in their backyard, looking at the northwest sky, because that's when the comet Hale-Bopp was visible.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
So... So these objects had a ready-made audience at that time, and it was like not just a single object, but like a parade of objects and lights that were seen both on the west side and on the east side of Phoenix. Now, the one that was coming down from the northwest and was traveling at fairly low altitude. It's almost impossible to say exactly what altitude. I was given various estimates by various witnesses, but it was low. And this was described what we would call it like a boomerang or a chevron shape, mm-hmm. You know, with the square end. And it was so large that it is possible that from the very leading edge to the trailing tip of this boomerang, it could have spanned anywhere from a half to 1 mile in length.
Wow. When you said VLO, you meant it.
I meant it. So this particular object, which had these two large arms, you know, that came out as if you were looking at a V or an A in the sky without the crossbar, right? Mm-hmm. And there were five lights on it. Okay, there was one white light on the leading tip, and then two on each arm. Now, others had seen seven lights in a kind of a V formation with one of the lights moving. This might have been a formation of lights, you know, an independent formation rather than an object. But this object was large enough that in Prescott, an observer said that it was as big as the Safeway supermarket when he looked up at it.
Hmm.
Somebody in the northern Phoenix area described it as being as large as the parking lot at the mall. So we're talking a fairly large sizes were described here.
What kind of conclusion, or did you come up with a conclusion? Was it a series of objects that together in a formation, or do you think it was just one?
The one that I'm describing now was one object, because people could see when it passed over close enough, and there was a family up on a hillside, and they declared that it was less than 1,000 feet when it passed over the hills. It was just gliding over them without making a sound. And it was so close that one of the main primary witnesses' children thought that he could toss a rock up and hit it. And so they had a very, very good view of this. And apparently it went across the approach flight path to Sky Harbor Airport and then kind of angled toward the south.
Well, were you able to find any official radar reports or sightings? I mean, it's something this large and right there.
Well, we got a report that one of the pilots taking off from Sky Harbor had seen these lights passing over the flight path.
Mm-hmm.
And radioed a message to air traffic control with questions as to whether he had any air traffic up there, or if he had it on radar. And they responded they had nothing on radar to indicate that there was anything crossing the flight path. We tried to, file a Freedom of Information request to get a report from the radar tape. But by the time our FOIA request was processed, according to them, the reply we got back was the tapes were already overwritten, that they only kept them for a limited number of days, and then they had to reuse them as a matter of economy. So we missed out on whether there was any radar return or not on that particular night. But there was a second large object that was seen passing almost directly from the north over Scottsdale, over Mesa, and over Chandler.
Mm-hmm.
And this object was described as triangular. And by the reflection of the lights in the city from below it, you could see the underside of this object. You could see that it was blocking out the stars. There was structure underneath this object, the underbelly of it. There were...
Now, when you say structured, what do you mean?
Well, witnesses described that they could see some kind of rectangular panels on the underside of this object. And this object was approximately twice size of the boomerang. So we're talking about probably one of the largest UFOs ever sighted. It had...
That's mind-boggling to think it could be that big.
Right. And also, I have now learned that separate witnesses have seen a beam of light coming out of the boomerang, and also a beam of light coming out of the triangle as it was traversing overhead. The triangle also had orbs accompanying it, and I have found out since, of course, and this is in the book, that other black triangles that have been seen in other parts of the United States and the UK have been seen accompanied by these glowing orbs. On that particular night, these orbs were amber in color. They look like a pure amber gold.
You're getting into what I was going to ask you from this email from a fellow named Howard. He said, studied the Phoenix Lights incident a lot and asked your guests about the orbs and if the colors mean anything. So I guess what he's talking about is there's different kinds of colors of orbs, I assume.
Yes, people have reported seeing these orbs.
Mm-hmm.
white.
Why don't you tell our listeners, the new people to UFO land, exactly what orbs, what we're talking about when we say orbs?
Well, now, it's just a slang term we've applied to a ball of light that seems to have limited dimensions. So some people have seen these up fairly close. I have seen videotape of one of these orbs at a fairly close range, within about 100 yards, and it was about the size of a basketball, and it glows with brilliant luminescence, and yet it does not illuminate the surrounding as you would expect of a bright light. In other words, there is no reflective property off of surrounding objects. It does not have glare or corona. Mm-hmm. It's very mysterious. Here's something that's very bright, and it's not lighting anything up.
And it's obviously some kind of inner light, I guess.
Now, that's what we saw in a formation and videotaped close to 10 o'clock on that same night.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that were referred to as flares being dropped by the Operation Snowbird, which was a contingent of the Maryland Air National Guard that was visiting Arizona and conducting night operations.
Well, I love the terminology of that snowbird in Arizona in the Phoenix area in March.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. So
that a lot of people seem to think that these triangles have some military application. What do you think? I mean,
I know there's been a lot of speculation that some of these triangles are reverse engineered from alien technology, and the military is flying them around. I cannot confirm that. I cannot deny that. I have no evidence either way that really supports that, other than testimony. Now, we do know that some people out here in the California desert, more around the Yucca Valley region that I've talked to, have seen some of these triangles flying at night with a faint blue glow around and doing abrupt maneuvers. And they have seen these escorted, or seemingly escorted, by helicopters. And that's very, very strange.
Now, why were these lights amber? You have no idea, I guess, but I mean...
The amber color?
Uh-huh.
No, I have no idea. It almost looked like pure gold. It was a very coherent color. In fact, we analyzed this on with a computer program, an image analyzer.
And what did you find out?
Well, we found out that the intensity of these lights was did not vary with time. We did a histogram on it, compared this with a histogram of flares that were also videotaped. And the flares, of course, are fires, and they flicker, and they change in intensity over a period of time. And you can see this in the histogram. In other words, if you take several frames from the video and feed it into the computer, then what you're going to get is you're going to get this jagged line going up and down that shows that the intensity is varying over a period of a minute or 2 minutes. And that is characteristic of something burning. These orbs did not have that characteristic. There was a rise in the graph, and then it would flatten out over time and would steady until the light would go out or extinguish, and then there was a rapid fall in the graph.
The Phoenix Lights Mystery is the name of the book. Bill Hamilton is the author, and we're going to take a break here, Bill. The mystery to me is, why do these lights, they haven't come back, have they?
There have been some sightings since then, and
okay.
I'll talk about that later.
Okay, good. We'll be back in a minute.
Have you ever thought about becoming a licensed private investigator? No need to pay hundreds of dollars in researching fees, because Hall of Fame member of the National Association of Investigative Specialists, Joe Culligan, has the answer for you. He's written the most comprehensive and complete reference manual available, giving you the information you need about the licensing requirements in all 50 states and elsewhere, so that you too can become a highly paid licensed private investigator. This manual is all beef and no bull, so you can become a private investigator part-time or full-time quickly by learning the requirements in all 50 states and more. Yes, you too can become a PI. Order Joe Culligan's Requirements to Become a PI book or video now. They make great gifts, too. only $19.95 plus postage shipped anywhere. To pay by check or credit card by phone, call 1-800-921-9898. 1-800-921-9898.
In California, we have Bill Hamilton in the high desert country right outside Palmdale, or in Palmdale, maybe. Anyway, Bill, welcome back to the show.
Oh, yes, thank you. Yes, I'm in Palmdale.
And Palmdale is quite a bit larger than it was when I was there in the late 60s. I was there, and all I had to do was go to three whole golf courses, and that was about it. Okay, now, we left everybody. You wrote this book called The Phoenix Lights Mystery, and you say there's been sightings since then, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, after that happened, all of us, you know, that's when I got involved with Skywatch, and we had some Skywatch parties, and we'd go out with telescopes, binoculars, and video cameras in an attempt to get some footage on some of these objects. And I got some of my first daylight footage about a month later. And then about 2 months later, I saw a very peculiar object traveling through the sky. It looked like five lights in a line, in a row. And this thing did a very odd thing. It pivoted when it turned. It turned toward the northwest, but pivoted just like a compass needle pivots in the center. And so we had some very, you know, in order to see a UFO, and a lot of people have asked me about this, you have to watch the sky. You have to be a sky watcher. You know, that's taking a kind of a proactive approach if you're really, really interested in this.
So, and do you have any tips for somebody out there? I mean, you just go out and start looking up?
You should be away from light pollution. And, of course, here in the desert, I could get out to an area where it's pretty dark, and I can see I can see the Milky Way in the sky. I know I have a very good view of the sky in all directions. And you should be a little familiar with the sky if you're going out at night sky watching. You know your directions. Know at least some of the major stars, planets, and constellations. And record your observations. Take note of the time. This is one thing that witnesses seldom do. They always go, well, I think it was around 8 o'clock, you know. Mm-hmm. Very few people look at the clock or your watch or whatever.
And that's actually pretty important.
Yeah, you know, you try to be observant and absorb all of the information you can, because I know some people are so stunned by seeing something unusual that they seem to, lose some rational control. But if you can regain that, then it is of benefit to the rest of us.
I'm really interested, and we don't really have all that much time tonight, but I want to get into it as much as we can.
Right.
This EBE thing. I mean, you've actually done a lot of investigating about it, right?
Well, yes. In fact, years and years ago, I started investigating what are called the crash retrieval stories, like the Roswell story.
Mm-hmm.
And I was corresponding.
Yeah, I think that's the first time I heard your name was something in conjunction with Roswell.
Well, I was corresponding with a man named Leonard Stringfield, who was talking to sources who wanted to remain anonymous, who had military experience, who wanted to talk about participating in a crash retrieval or recovery experience of their own. And through some of these stories, we learned that some of the bodies of the pilots of these the craft were recovered as well, and even were told that some of them were alive when found. And I know this sounds extremely strange, but some of these stories come from sources that cross-correlate with each other on the information they give. So I decided to pick one particular story that came up, which what's in kind of what Stan Friedman calls his gray basket. Well, it was in my gray basket. I didn't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And there's a story told of one of these entities that was found alive, and that a great deal of a learning had gone on where they established communication with this particular entity, and they gave him a name, and the name they gave him was J-Rod. And, you know, I kind of put, like I said, put that in my gray basket, and mm-hmm. suddenly somebody else came up with this, and then somebody else authenticated that they had heard of J-Rod, and I started gathering information, and pretty soon a document came into my hands, and it goes on from there. It becomes very mysterious, but I decided to, because this document had a great deal of information involving genetics and microbiology, I have been cracking the books on genetics and microbiology.
Mm-hmm.
And what I am finding is a new paradigm, a paradigm in a new field called astrobiology. And that paradigm is called cosmic ancestry. And what it says here is life here on Earth came here from elsewhere, from out there, from space, that all the elements of life that exist in space, even DNA. So, since DNA can only come from DNA, the possibility now exists that if the DNA fell on this planet and it encoded like a packaged program in DNA is the sequence for evolution of life on a planetary surface triggered by environmental conditions, so that it would bring about various forms of living organisms, that these living organisms would follow a pattern that pre-existed. And that could explain why there are so many sightings and encounters with UFO entities that describe them as basically humanoid. In other words, one head, two arms, two legs,
mm-hmm.
not eight tentacles, right? It's all in the DNA pattern. So it's getting really, really fascinating as I start playing off what we're learning in science against what we are learning in ufology. In other words, we have to do a lot of studies here to try to make sense of all of this. So that's where my current research is taking me.
So are you saying that someone dropped off a DNA package with certain conditions when they arose environmentally, that this would actually evolve?
No, not that someone dropped it off, that this occurs naturally, that there are so many, you could call them cosmic collisions. I mean, meteors and comets rain down on this planet for 700 million years before life developed.
So we're talking about a cosmic soup like Carl Sagan used to refer to.
Yep, you could say so.
This J-Rod, that interests me in that in the name alone. Is that, are those initials for something, you think?
Well, yeah. As I understand it, came about because there were two symbols that were used, and one looked like a J and one looked like a bar or a rod. So they put this together and just called them that. But apparently, like many of these entities, as described by those who've had close encounters, J-Rod had the ability to convey his thoughts mentally.
Mm-hmm. So the language was not a barrier?
No, not a complete barrier.
Mm-hmm. Now, is J-Rod still alive?
I don't know that. The last information I have on J-Rod comes from 1994. He was alive in 1994, but he had a condition. There was some kind of degenerative condition of his nervous system that was being investigated.
So J-Rod was ill.
Yeah, in a way that... they could not fully understand why his neuronal pathways were degenerating the way they were. And I don't know whether it had to do with you know, he was housed in an environmental chamber. So maybe they were trying to protect him from something they thought was in the environment that could be injuring him. And the rumors are that one of the early crash retrievals, a designation called EBE-1 or EB-1,
mm-hmm.
Survived a period of years and died mysteriously. So maybe they're prolonged.
In other words, the Earth environment's hazardous to their health.
In a prolonged stay, mm-hmm. unless they're in an environmental habitat or something like that.
Now, your wife, Pam, has helped you a great deal. She's I've heard good things about her, too. Does she help you in research?
Oh, yeah. She's a very good observer. We have both seen things together. We have skywatched together, and we mm-hmm. had a little experience together back on March 16, 1993, when we were out off Highway 375 near Area 51.
Kind of experience.
Well, we saw something taking off from the ground, and that something was the brightest thing I've ever seen in the night sky, and it only went up about maybe, 20, 25 feet above the ground and started racing through the sky directly toward my position in my pickup truck, and I became fully alert at that time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I believe we had about 20 minutes of missing time. Now I have run across a case that I've been investigating since 1999, but the investigation has gotten very thick and heavy, you might say, recently, on a scientist who is a microbiologist who was also at S4 a few years ago. He is still in the project. He is still employed. He is still working at a very, very high level. And apparently his knowledge, his techniques are somehow indispensable to his employer.
Hello, Bill Hamilton. I don't want to give away any secrets here, but I'm just curious. Did you run across him by accident, or did you seek him out?
No. What happened was a very good friend of his put out a message on the Internet, and I responded to it because what intrigued me was there was a document involved with this, and I was interested in documents, and of course I know somebody who's making an examination of documents. And the only thing is, this document had no security markings because it was a draft document. And this man's boss made a copy of it, a Xerox copy of it, and leaked it out. And it does say it is, but it is only a typewritten on the document that it is classified Cosmic Magic under authority of Top Secret Executive Decision 91-1812-4A. And it is under authorization from the government of the United States of America, Department of Defense, Department of the Navy, Naval Intelligence Command, Naval Space Command. And what was so remarkable and that caught my eye about this document was it mentions an extraterrestrial biological entity that was being examined by this microbiologist. And they had given this entity a designation. And I had heard it before from another source. And I thought, what does this mean? And they called this entity J-Rod. And I had heard from a mechanical engineer in fact, who had gone public on this, that he had been working on a flying saucer simulator, and that one of the, you might say, the supreme boss as far as knowledge of what the simulator was to do was an extraterrestrial by the name of J-Rod. There were so many specific references in this particular document that I contacted this person, and for a period of time I was unsuccessful in trying to get any interest in this case, and I was my contact person seemed so skittish about it, because apparently there were various threats made against this man, and I am going to mention his name as it is known now. He is Dr. Dan Burish.
Burish?
Burish.
And you say as he's known now, so that was all.
Well, he had his name changed, whether he was urged to or not, because in this document he was known under a former name of Dr. Dan Crane, Captain, United States Navy. He is he's a graduate of initially of the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. But he also went to New York University, where he got his degree in microbiology. Now, just to indicate, as a microbiologist, he received his PhD in 1989 in New York. And New York University, which once acknowledged his record, as I guess started to deny having a record of him, but documents exist showing that his educational record, so that's a positive. And he first graduated with a BA from UNLV in 1986 when he was first approached as a candidate for working on a project for the government. And from the time period 1982 to 1985, he is listed as a biologist and owner of Crane Environment Research in Las Vegas. And he had submitted a proposal to NASA at that time, just to, now this is a little technical, but just to kind of indicate what he was working on and what level his mind was working on. This proposal was entitled On the Transplantation of Protozoa and the Exploitation of Martian Exobiology, the case for Euglena viridis in the automated biological laboratory. He has an intense interest in Mars, its anomalies, and its potentials for life. NASA replied to this proposal, and I have a copy of this. Your project has been found to contain sufficient intrinsic merit as to enable integration into NSCORT Bioregenerative Life Support Division, a subdirectorate of the Controlled Ecological Life Support Systems Program of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. But later, as he got involved with the project at Site 4, Nevada, he was eventually assigned to be the working group leader in Project Aquarius, R-4800 Papu Site 4. And he worked in the underground biological lab that was installed on level 4. The security procedures for entering this area included optical, retinal scan, and voice print identification. It was absolutely necessary for him to shower, shave, decontaminate, and change clothing when required before entering the lab, as they had classified it as a biosafety level of 5. And biosafety level of 4 is the highest that's found in OSU manuals on biosafety levels.
So
he was, he had seen some of the same briefing books as Bob Lazar had been exposed to. However, coming from a biological angle on this, he understood more about the extraterrestrial biological forms, but he did not know that that was what he was working on to begin with. He was only asked to do certain tasks and work on certain things in a in the lab.
Certain things, you mean certain microbiology specimens?
Yeah, certain microbes, certain specimens that were gathered, and he was asked to do things that he thought were almost nearly impossible to accomplish, and he was working in the blind, and since it was so compartmentalized, and there was little communication that he could share with other scientists on the project, and initially he was not briefed that it was extraterrestrial specimens that he was working on, so he was finding it quite astounding. Some things that he was finding in cell structures were quite astounding to him at the time. And when it was revealed to him that these were specimens were taken from a living, intelligent entity that was held in captivity there in an environmental chamber, it just had a tremendous mental and emotional impact on his life.
Well, I'm sure it did. So J-Rod was there where, in Nevada or China Lake or where?
He was in this underground, I think it was down on level 5, in a sphere, a containment sphere, because they had a slightly different mix of atmosphere in it that was beneficial to him and was consistent with the atmospheric mix on his native planet,
the
state of reticuli system.
Do what now?
The native planet that J-Rod came from was in what we call the Zeta Reticuli.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I've heard that same thing before from other sources.
Now, here's how this happened. See, there's a little bit of a background to this, and of course, I only have bits and pieces of it.
Bill, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, let's get into the backgrounds and the bit and pieces. This is a phenomenal sitting on the edge of your chair type story.
Right.
And I don't want to get into it and have to do the break, so I'm going to go ahead and take the break now, okay?
Okay.
And we'll be back here in a moment.
This is UFO Files, and we will continue. Tonight, our music is from a new CD, dedicated to the SETI project, the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, and it's by Janice Music, and it's sent to me from our listeners in London, England. But right now, let's pause for these words.
Now, Goldie's Music has compiled the very best of Dean Martin in a 3-CD package called
Everybody Loves Somebody Somehow.
You get 36 of the very best of Dean Martin.
Send me the pillow that you dream of.
This greatest hits package is not available in stores, but only available through this special radio offer. It's the very best of Dean Martin.
You're nobody till somebody loves you. So find yourself some.
All songs have been digitally remastered for the highest possible quality. Add the very best of Dean Martin to your collection today. Here's how to order.
To order, call now 1-800-662-3995. That's 1-800-662-3995. Get the best of Dean Martin. Call now 1-800-662-3995.
It's an interesting, in fact, one of those things where you sit on the edge of your chair when you listen to our guest Bill Hamilton talk about this. And Bill, we left at a very important part of this this whole investigation you're doing. You found this guy in 1999, and you've been following up with a little research on him, and it evidently is beginning to pay off. You're finding out some pretty interesting things.
Yes. Well, there's another aspect to this, and that is about 6 months ago, I started having an intense interest in the subject of astrobiology. And it's a really exploding subject in the NASA community and even outside of the NASA community. And there seems to be a redoubling of efforts to locate life elsewhere in our galaxy. And it's even estimated now, I just saw a recent estimate that when we find Earth-like planets, that the probability is 1 out of 3 will be life-bearing planets. that could run into quite a few numbers.
I started to say, that already sounds, that's pretty incredible. So you're talking about 1 out of 3, 1 out of 4, something like that?
Of Earth-like mm-hmm. rocky planets. Yes, 1 out of 3.
Incredible.
That's the estimate. In fact, another estimate came out a few weeks ago just by computer modeling that there could be as many as billions of inhabited planets, of life-bearing planets in our galaxy. That's quite a high number.
It certainly is.
And even if we just cut that number down to 1/100 of that, it's still a high number. It's in the millions. So the possibility and the probabilities are there. The problem is, with all these astrobiologists interested in extraterrestrial life, we have only a few of them that are being exposed to real extraterrestrial life present here on the Earth, and that information is not being disclosed. It's not being disseminated. It is within the province of the national security state of the United States. So all levels of information on extraterrestrial biological entities are classified. And the problem is we don't know why. There's a big mystery about this. Why keep it secret? Well, after putting together a few pieces to this puzzle, I'm beginning to understand what one of the probabilities is for keeping it secret. We know that there are definite witnesses who say that a craft, an extraterrestrial craft, crash-landed north of Roswell, New Mexico, 1947, that there was a survivor, a living being, from that crash, or one of the crashes, early on. And the scientists that studied these entities called them extraterrestrial biological entities. And they designated the first survivor as EB-1. EB-1. And EB-1 was housed in a special facility at Los Alamos in New Mexico and lived until 1949. And I don't know what happened, whether this entity was exposed to some kind of microorganism on the Earth that it could not resist, or, you know, it died. Another entity, and I'm not too sure when this entity arrived, sometime maybe in the 1970s or 80s, was designated EB2. EB2 was hard to contain from some of the notes that I have. And
by that, you mean he didn't want to stay a captive?
Well, yeah. In other words, he had an ability, a facility to elude being a captive, to go where he wanted to go at any particular time. So I know that they had some difficulties with EB2. What happened to EB2, I'm not sure. But somewhere along the line comes EB3. But EB3 came on with some kind of a negotiated agreement and brought two assistants with him. One assistant, as I understand it, was of the female gender. And how they tell this, I don't know. But that assistant was sent to a secret project at Los Alamos. The other assistant, a male, was J-Rod. And J-Rod was sent to Groom Lake. And I know at least one of the things that J-Rod was working on was on the reverse engineering project. Then EB3 and the assistant from Los Alamos returned to their home planet November 1994. This information comes from not just one source, but multiple sources.
And when they returned like that, did somebody come and get them, or did we just let them go?
No, they just announced that they were going back, and at that particular time, and I do not know the story behind this, but the group called Majestic, who was in charge, would not allow J-Rod to leave and go back. So J-Rod thinks of himself as a captive.
He's kind of a EBE without a country, or without a planet.
Yeah, he was referred to as a guest of the government, but he thinks he's of himself as a captive, and he's not real friendly toward some of the military and scientists involved. But he was friendly, for some unknown reason, with Dr. Crane. One of the things that was being done here, the attempt was to find out why there was a neural degeneration going on in J-Rod's system. There was some kind of neural degeneracy going on, and that's why they had to take specimens and samples and with the intent of doing some reverse genetic engineering. And this is the program that Dan Crane was involved in at Site 4. And there were other projects going on there, and he listed, and I have found out more about these other projects, but among the projects were Project Sigma, Project Galileo, which is the one that Lazar talked about working on, the propulsion system. There was Project Sidekick, dealing with a beam weapon potential of the craft and the prototype for one. And there was a very interesting project called Looking Glass, which dealt with time travel experiments. And I have received more information than was ever released by Lazar, who claimed not to know much about these other projects that he was not involved in.
Wow. Bill Hamilton, clock has us. Can you hold on for another hour? Tell you what, next time we're here, folks, we'll have Bill Hamilton back. He'll talk a little bit more about Area 51 and crash retrievals of UFOs. Don't forget the big conference this weekend, Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada, at Sunset Station. We'll be broadcasting from there. Larry Dickin is our producer. This is Jerry Pippin. Good night.